All right, thank you. So I'm Kelly Reynolds, and I come to you from the Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And I'm definitely a switch of gears here. I'm an environmental microbiologist, and one of the things that I was doing with this study is to try and use tools in microbiology and mathematical risk assessment modeling to validate and inform ARTS for Behavioral Change programs. And so that's where we partnered to do this study. Just a little bit about my co-authors on this presentation. Dr. Ryan Sinclair is from Loma Linda University. He's here in the audience. And Dr. Robert Canales is our risk modeler. Ryan helped a lot in the field and with some of the study design. He's also a microbiologist. Marcelo Soto Beltran is here from the Clorox Company. Margarita Molina and Mary Penny were our partners in Peru and the laboratory there who helped us with some of the field sampling and analysis and data analysis. That's me in the picture in the pink shirt, and this is the community that we worked with in peri-urban Lima, Peru. So just as a disclosure, this study was funded by the Clorox Company. And as an introduction to the problem, right now about 1 billion people currently live in shanty towns or slums, which are marked by crowded conditions, poor water and wastewater infrastructure, and lack of hygiene practices, all of which lead to disease transmission. It's predicted that by 2030, this number will double. There'll be 2 billion people living in these types of conditions, these types of slums or shanty towns. So that was some incentive to start to develop some programs where we could have some effect for change. So that brings us to this unique opportunity, which was partnering with Canaan Ranch Institute, who will be presenting the next presentation telling you about their ARTS for Behavioral Change program, and I'm going to be talking about the microbial tools we use to evaluate that intervention. So our project goal overall was to collaboratively develop solutions to these health challenges. And my particular study objective as the microbiologist on the project was to use microbial monitoring to evaluate the baseline risk of infectious disease, what is the community being exposed to, and also determine the relationship of that disease transmission with their environment and their relationship in particular to home hygiene, individual home hygiene. So to as part of this, we wanted to determine critical control points within the home that could be, say, put into some of the messaging for the ARTS and Behavioral Change program for the future, and also to evaluate what we can, where we can have the greatest impact for control. So our first step was to conduct a preliminary pilot study where we visited the community and got an idea about the demographics and, in particular, what types of infectious diseases were occurring in the community. There have been several papers published from the region stating that Listeria and Salmonella and diarrhea-causing E. coli were some of the primary pathogenic organisms of concern. And so we targeted E. coli as an indicator, fecal indicator bacteria, but also Listeria and Salmonella in our household surveys. We also wanted to determine what the laboratory capacity was. It was very good. We worked with a really great team down there. They were well supplied, well experienced in these types of studies. And in particular, we wanted to look at the actual homes and to see what types of environments were there that we could sample. Where could we have controls initiated? Where could surfaces be disinfected, water be treated? You know, what type of facilities are we talking about where there can be some change initiated? One of the things that we discovered was in this area here, this is what they call a cueco in Peru, and this was gray water waste disposal. And so any waste from the kitchen, you know, any kind of gray water dishwashing waste would be dumped in these pits outside. And in times where it was dry in the season, then you'd have good drainage of these wacos, but oftentimes there wasn't good drainage, and so once these overflowed, it just went into the streets, and so you have dogs coming along and drinking and eating out of the wacos, and lots of dog waste, lots of moisture all the way around, which is not very conducive to hygienic conditions. Another picture of just the moisture kind of overflow running through the streets. And then clearly there were some mixed-use sites. Here you see where laundry's being clean. There's also a latrine and garbage being disposed, pets mixed into the area, they're eating out of the garbage, and so this was an indoor facility, part of one of the homes where we were doing the sampling, and so there's a separate food prep area, but there's just a lot of combination of activities going on and high rates of potential cross-contamination and disease transmission within the home. This is an aerial picture of the actual community where we sampled. In this clearing here, this is where the ARTS for Behavioral Change performances took place, And then you can see some of the pictures of the locations of the homes where we actually went in and sampled. We tried to recruit 1 in 10 homes, which would be a target number of about 36 of the households. And you can see where the homes are located around the plaza. A little bit misleading because there was an elevation change with each layer of these homes, which you'll see in some subsequent pictures. Here you see a picture of some of the behavioral change programs that were going on. Within this program, the community was involved, lots of dancing, lots of singing, a really happy time, and also messages of hygiene and water treatment and hand hygiene incorporated into these performances and these plays that they were putting on. So our field-based methods in pre- and post-intervention, we went into the home and used a standard quantitative swabbing technique to sample surfaces within the homes. So some of the homes had sort of mock toilets for their latrine, but it actually just emptied into a pit. There was no running water, no flushing mechanism. But so we had a wide variety of types of surfaces that were serving as a latrine that we were sampling. But overall, we sampled both porous, which are things like dish rags, cloth-type surfaces, and then also non-porous surfaces, which are more amenable to actual surface disinfection. So these are hard, non-porous surfaces like cutting boards, flush handles, things like that, but wash buckets. And we sampled primarily kitchen and bathroom environments. We also sampled the hands of the residents in the home and the water supply. The methods we used were standard quantitative methods, again, of swabbing, neutralizing the swab in case there were disinfectants being used. And we used a standard quantitative most probable number enrichment culture to isolate the E. coli, listeria, and salmonella. And then we used selective culture confirmation, multiple steps to make sure when we did get a positive result, it was actually the pathogen we were targeting. So these are the results of the pre-intervention study, so before the Arts for Behavioral Change program was initiated. And we found overall, if you just look at the top lines here, 30% of all the surfaces we tested were positive for listeria. That's a very high rate of a frank pathogen to be isolated. 62% of the surfaces were positive for E. coli, fecal indicator bacteria. 22% in both cases of the finger samples that we collected from the resident the people living in the residences were positive also for listeria and fecal bacteria, so really high rates. And I just want to draw your attention to the site that was identified with the highest concentration, which are the fingers. Regardless of organism, the fingers were obviously a critical control point identified in the study. The other thing I want to draw your attention to is just the frequency of positives. We're not really sure what really drives risk, if it's the frequency of the contact with the pathogen or if it's the concentration of the pathogen itself, and that's where our risk models come in and can be helpful to us. But I want to draw those two points out to you before we get into discussion of the model. So the post-intervention results, a little bit hard to interpret. That's why I'm not showing you a side-by-side table, because some things went up, some markers went down. A little bit hard for us to interpret. But overall, the percent positives went down. They generally decreased. Regardless of site, if you looked at all the surfaces combined, the percent positive decreased by over 3%. Regardless of organism, percent positive decreased by almost 8%. Now, when you look at concentration, however, we had increases in concentration. So there may actually be environmental factors at play, different temperatures, different humidity levels that might be conducive for growth of the organism. So we saw a reduction in frequency, but an increase in concentration. And again, we're not sure which really drives the risk. Okay, so one thing that was really encouraging, though, was that the sites that were highlighted in the Arts for Behavioral Change performances, in particular the food prep areas, definitely decreased in the percent positives by 34% for the food prep areas, which was a major message in the performances. So that was encouraging. But overall, we're still dealing with an environment, whether you think of pre- or post-intervention, that needs a lot of help for identifying critical control points and reducing exposures, unacceptable risk levels. This is a data summary of all the sites collectively analyzed, the pre and the post together, and the fingers still emerge as that top critical control point. The red zone, the number 3, means the highest concentration of organisms isolated, and the food prep area came in a close second. Now, this is the data table. One of the things that in the literature you find a lot with these types of assessments is people will report the mean and the standard deviation of the concentrations. And what we really need for risk assessment is to know what some of the extreme values are, because that's where the highest risk is. So I draw your attention to this column with listeria on fingers. We saw some fingers tested positive for 1,500 organisms of Listeria. The infectious dose is less than 10. So this was really concerning that we had such high levels of contamination on a direct contact site like the fingers that's preparing food, comes into direct contact with the face. So that was a concern. But those are the kinds of data points we really need to really evaluate the risk assessment effectively. So I keep mentioning this risk assessment model. The next phase that we went into was developing this mathematical quantitative model so we could estimate from our field data what that means in terms of risk when people get exposed. And we did this specifically for non-dietary exposures to Listeria monocytogenes, which is a frank pathogen. This is the first study looking at exposure to Listeria that isn't in food that's been published, so non-dietary exposures. So our first step in the risk assessment was to develop a model to estimate the likelihood of transfer. If you have contamination on a surface, what's the likelihood it will get transferred to your fingers? And we had to deal with this looking at transfer efficiency, first of all, but also taking into consideration the fractional surface area. You don't always come into contact with your entire hand around a fomite. Sometimes it's just the fingertips. And so we had to evaluate the distribution possibilities that sometimes you come into contact with only a portion of the hand and sometimes the whole hand. So we built on data that previously was published by a group out of Stanford, where they looked at videotapes of people and their activity patterns to see how often your hand comes into full contact versus partial contact with surfaces. And that went into our quantitative model. The second step, you never know what people are going to do with their hands. And so one of the things that we had to evaluate here was once your hand is contaminated, what's the likelihood your hand will come into contact with your mouth? And so we have data on that, again, from the literature, from videotape analysis, mostly with children. How that relates to adults is a little something. One of the things we had to assume, but also again, you have to assume the transfer efficiency. You come into contact with how many fingers at a time. So we put that distribution of possibilities into our quantitative model as well, and then we came up with a concentration that you expect on the hand that would be transferred to the mouth. Then we utilized a dose response model. This was also developed from both human outbreak studies, but also mice studies, looking at how Listeria, when you do come into contact with it, the probability that it will cause infection. And so there are specific parameters for Listeria in particular that make an adjustment. If you have a specific dose, what's the likelihood you'll have an infection? And so we have this dose response model incorporated in our risk assessment model as well. Bless you. So quickly getting to some of the results, this was a simulated time series looking at a single individual in 1 hour, what the likelihood is of Listeria at higher concentrations being deposited onto the hand from contact with a surface. When you see the peaks going up, that's Listeria on the hand. When it goes down, the hand is touched to surface and you get transfer of Listeria back to the surface. And over time, you have this interplay, cross-contamination, and eventually the contamination starts to go down because you've transferred it, but then it levels out because you keep contaminating your hands. If you look at the same type of simulation over a 4-hour time period, you see that the contacts increase. So this is intuitive that this would happen, but what this helps us do is to quantitatively evaluate when the contamination occurs. So we can start to look at what happens if we have an intervention here where the hands were washed and then the levels go down to zero, and how long does it take for the surfaces to recontaminate the hands. So we can mathematically simulate interventions of that effect. The next thing that we wanted to do is to look at, once you have it on the hands from our model that we showed you previously, what's the likelihood that you'll have an infection? And so this is a 1-hour dose response simulation with 1,000 people. So we're looking now at a population of people and the likelihood of, if they get exposed to the distributions that we've previously calculated from the environmental data, what's the likelihood that they'll get sick? So in a 1-hour time frame, you have a spread of the dose response. So you can have low exposures for a portion of the population and high exposures for another portion of the population. What happens over a 4-hour time frame is you have much fewer people at the lower range not getting infected. So essentially everybody starts to get exposed and starts to get infected. And so again, it's intuitive that we can start to see what's the effect if we can start to tell people, wash your hands twice a day, you know, disinfect a surface 3 times a day, once a day, once a week, and we can insert these simulations and see what happens to the risk. So that hopefully we get into this lower dose zone of more acceptable risk. So this, again, is looking at a population of 1,000 people, probability of response, and eventually it starts to level out because everybody gets exposed. Some of the population remains protected. They never get sick from this Listeria. So we see a peak of about a 60% probability of getting infected for a population. 60% of the population will experience effects. So basically our limitations, I talked a little bit about that we're using child data. We're actually underestimating the risk if we wanted to apply this to children because they have a lot of object-to-mouth contacts, and we didn't consider that here. For adults, we assume there's fewer object-to-mouth contacts, but as I look out, I see people chewing their pens and holding their sunglasses, so that may not necessarily be true, but children definitely have a lot more object-to-mouth contacts. So for a child, if we wanted to apply this model to a child, we would change the frequency of contacts a little bit. We didn't evaluate gender differences. All of our subjects in this study were female in the home. Okay, thank you. And one of the things that we need to better evaluate, we don't have good data on, is transfer efficiency in changing environmental conditions. And this might help to explain some of our results from this study. And one time it would be a wet season, another time it would be a dry season when we went back. So inactivation and growth were not included in this, mainly because Listeria is very hardy. It tends to not be inactivated in the environment at the levels we were seeing, but there could actually be regrowth, especially if it gets into food and dish rags and things like that. So we considered that there was no growth or inactivation, and that may be underestimating the risk a little bit as well. So the final point is that our opportunity using these tools is that we can start to evaluate interventions through these simulations, which are a little bit cheaper to do than the field studies, but we have the field studies to validate and inform not only the model, but say the future arts and behavioral change program, so we can help to inform what messages should be in there, what are going to be the most effective interventions, what's the time and frequency we should target those types of controls to get us into that acceptable risk limit zone. I just want to recognize our other partners on this project, and I thank you for your attention.